You found the show that uncovers how the radical progressive narrative is taking over American colleges and universities.
So now they're going to use coercion to force people to take it. Maybe they should be asking themselves why on a liberal campus their ideas are not more popular. They're not penetrating. That's the one thing they don't want to talk about, is why they have to force people.
This is Freeborn and Liberty. We're diving deep into the heart of the woke machine.
Hey everyone, Dan Freeborn here, your host for Freeborn and Liberty. As we've talked about on the show before, critical race theory teaches that some races are inherently better than other races, and while it's flaunted as being a solution to anti-racism, it's actually quite the opposite. It is racism, and many colleges and universities are mandating courses or trainings that are steeped in this theory. My guest today is William Jacobson. He's clinical professor of law and director of the Securities Law Clinic at Cornell Law School. He is also founder of the conservative website Legal Insurrection, which is affiliated with the Legal Insurrection Foundation, a tax-exempt research and investigative entity based in Rhode Island. Professor Jacobson has been heavily involved in the creation of criticalrace.org, which is an interactive online database of universities that teach critical race theory. Professor Jacobson, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on.
Absolutely. Well, let's dive into things right away. Criticalrace.org is becoming fast becoming a really widely used resource for parents and students as they're searching colleges and where they should be attending. Can you elaborate a little bit more on what criticalrace.org is and how it works and why you built it? Was there a tipping point for you that brought this all to be?
Sure. I'll try to take those in pieces. The what it is essentially a database of academic offerings and events and other things in higher education that I think at least loosely fall under the rubric of critical race theory. And some of the things we have on there don't, but people get to judge. So it's a database that tells you what is happening at now over 300 colleges and universities in the United States. Not every school on there has mandatory training or mandatory coursework. You can find out. If your school's on there yet, you can just look and find out. It is a interactive map of the United States. You can hover over with your mouse and click on the state, and then it will list the schools in that state. So it's a very interactive database, graphically easy to use. We also have a lot of other resources on the website, such as what is critical race theory, how people can learn about it, so different educational resources, links to articles by many leading scholars about it. We also have sections for K through 12. Even though the website was originally dedicated to higher education, we found that that's a huge need. And so we are providing resources there. Not a map yet, but other resources. We have a complete separate section on the 1619 Project. And I think that we will be rolling out and expanding the website. It's a big priority. We rolled it out on, I think it was February 4 of this year. So it's relatively new, but it got just enormous, enormous attention, actually shocking attention to me. I thought it would be a nice little project of the Legal Insurrection Foundation, and it's turned into this thing. We just happened to catch the issue at the right moment. Which kind of gets me to the other part of your question, which is how did it come about and why did we do it? And fortunately, this is a podcast, not a 7-minute radio interview, so I can give you some full explanation, the beauty of podcasts. Okay. So we have covered for a decade what I think now is called cancel culture on campuses. We've seen it develop, we've covered it, we've seen it migrate from campus to high tech, from campus to the broader culture. Part of that cancel culture were issues related to race, the demonization of people who disagreed on policy issues. So if you opposed Obamacare, you were called a racist. And this use of race as a accusations of racism as a political weapon. So we saw all of this going on, but we never really treated it as a separate subject at Legal Insurrection until last year. And what changed was the death of George Floyd and the surge of rioting and looting, but as relates to academia, the attempt to impose the doctrine of critical race theory on campuses. Now, they don't call it critical race theory most of the time. The euphemism is anti-racism, which, of course, is really one of the genius linguistic sleights of hand in history, because they take something which actually is racist and they call it anti-racist. And therefore, if you oppose it, you're a bad person. So to the extent I use the term anti-racist, I'm using it the way they use it, not that I buy into it. And so I saw all this. I became a target of cancel culture at Cornell Law School because I criticized the rioting and the looting. And I also wrote a post, which I'd written before. It actually was like a rerun of posts about how the Michael Brown hands up, don't shoot was a fabricated narrative. It is the formative narrative of the Black Lives Matter movement. And it's fabricated. It never happened. The Justice Department under Eric Holder and Barack Obama found it never happened. Yet it is the foundational narrative. And so I wrote about this, and then people tried to get me fired. There were boycotts, et cetera. So all of this is kind of going on at the same time. And then in mid-July of last year, as I'm going through all this, the president of Cornell University issued a statement announcing that anti-racist ideology would become embedded in all aspects of campus. And she immediately imposed certain requirements on staff, but sent it to the Faculty Senate to discuss requirements and mandates on students and faculty. And when I saw that, we began to research it. And I was originally going to write an op-ed or an article or a blog post about it. In fact, I did write a blog post about it. But we can do something more, try to get attention to it. And as we as a team began to look into it, we realized that this was much bigger than we thought. That there were a lot of universities moving in this direction, school districts, corporations, to impose this ideology on people. And sometime in September, we decided, you know what, we need a separate website for this. And the actual triggering event was on, I believe it was September 7th, 2020, several hundred Cornell University faculty, staff, and students signed a list of demands. And they issued an open letter or demands, open demands, and posted it someplace and had people sign up with Google Forms. You know how that goes. And it really was pretty horrific. It called for race-based hiring, which would be illegal. It called for other race-based actions. And really, it's what they envisioned the campus would look like under the president's directive. Now, the president didn't call for illegal hiring, but the faculty did. And it was literally at that moment that we decided as a team, you know what, we've got to push this out there. We've got to do it in a different way. So we hired somebody to design the database. We hired people to enter the data and do the research. The hope was to roll it out before the election, but that didn't happen for technical reasons. And then as we were approaching the election, oh, well, you know, in a couple of weeks, the election will die down. It'll be done. And then we can roll this out like the first week in December.
Okay. Wouldn't that have been nice?
Right. Well, as we know, the election didn't just go away. And then we're moving to Christmas and it's still not gone away. And I figured, you know what, we're ready to roll this thing out, but no one will pay attention to it. I mean, if we roll it out in the middle of all this, no one will pay attention. So we stalled and we stalled. And finally, we saw a window of opportunity after the inauguration, but before the impeachment trial. That's how crazy times we live in. Okay. And we timed it right. We timed it right. It was that first week in February when it was as slow a news cycle as we've had in, you know, 4 years, but certainly in 3 to 4 months. And we rolled it out and we got a lot of articles written about it. And I realized that we are onto something here, that I was on Tucker Carlson at 8:30 on a Thursday night. Okay. By midnight, we had 400,000 visits to the website. And that's not like a drudge link where you just click on a button. People had to type it. They heard him and me say criticalrace.org like 10 times, criticalrace.org. People had to type it in. At one point, we had 70,000 people on the website. It's a miracle it didn't crash. Anybody who's run a website, that's just like insane traffic. That's like major network traffic to have that many people on at one moment. And we realized that we're onto something. And so we have been building it up, building it out, expanding the list of schools, going into more depth on schools, and adding K through 12 resources. And that's what it is. And that's how we got here.
Well, the work you're doing is really appreciated, and I would commend you on the timing of releasing and, you know, launching the site, because it was ideal. And I think as a testament, you know, starting with 200 schools that were listed on the in the database and now having close to 300 or over 300, I mean, that's great in just a matter of a few months. And I want to drill in on that a little bit too. I mean, the sheer amount of research that's got to be going into collecting this information, it's got to be a big undertaking. How are you collecting the data? What's involved with that?
Well, we have a database, and on the back end of the website, we had a special WordPress template created so that we can fill in the information on a template and then, you know, fill in various boxes with information, and that translates into what you see on the website. So it's relatively efficient to do it that way. And the way we research it is Google, going to school websites, drilling down through them. It's very time consuming. So far, everything we have published is publicly sourced. There are public links. We have not published leaked documents, things like that. Maybe we will eventually, because there are other people doing such things. But as of now, every single piece of information has a link to it. You can click over it. And we also archive every single link, because I know links go bad, sometimes intentionally, sometimes unintentionally. And so everything is secured there, but it's a lot of work, and we're presenting information to people that they could find on their own if they had the time, but who has the time?
That's a key part, I think, for sure, because sometimes you don't even know what to search for at a university. I mean, you could talk, you're not going to type in critical race theory on a college's website. It's not going to pull anything up. So knowing...
Well, it would probably pull a lot. At some, it would pull up a lot. But the point is that a lot of the information that we've linked, these are public links, but they're not on the homepage of the university. You might have to drill down multiple levels. You might have to go to a certain institute at the university and work off of their website. So we've put in the time, and I'm not going to say we're comprehensive. We're not. Some of these larger universities, you could literally go on forever. So we try to pick the main points, and every single school page has a link so people can click on it and update the information. It's essentially an auto-generated Google search, okay? And it's Google search, I forget, we've time limited it to the last 30 days. And we have the search term, I can't remember if it's it's the university name. So it auto-generates the university name and then the words either anti-racism or critical race, whatever it is. So it may have been a number of months since we updated that entry. You can click on it and you can see what at least a Google search is pulling up in the last 30 days. And so it's really a method of empowering people. It's not the end result. It's not, and it doesn't purport to tell people what to do. It simply is a tool to save people a ton of time and to check out schools that might be of interest to them.
And it sounds like from what I've seen too, using the website, it's not just places where critical race theory is being mandated through trainings or curriculum. It's just how it's been adopted on a campus per se, whether it be a guest speaker coming in. I mean, I noticed a few of them, highlighting that, you know, Ibram X. Kendi was welcomed as a guest speaker as part of their campus-wide reading initiative of how to be an anti-racist.
Right.
I wouldn't say it was a mandate, but it just goes to show how this
right.
is.
In some places, it's a mandate, but it also speaks to the campus culture. If there's a lot of activity going on, it reflects the campus culture. And sometimes it's hard to decide, you know, is this critical race theory versus traditional diversity? Okay. And so we list it all and let you decide. And we try to provide a short explanation for each school, our analysis, but a lot of times it's difficult. There are all sorts of euphemisms that get passed around. Diversity, equity, and inclusion. Well, equity is the key word there. Equity is essentially the critical race. Equity is the anti-racism, the Kennedy approach, which is, you know, everything that is not equal is racist. And the remedy for past racism is current racism. That's Kennedy's point. So we try to present the information. We present the Google search that people can do. And it's an educational tool for people. It's not a blacklist. It's not a boycott list. It's not a don't go list. Sometimes people who don't actually read the website, that's what they assume. And that's the way some in the media, not all, but some in the media tried to portray it when we rolled it out, was that this is a list of schools to avoid. And it's not. First of all, if you had to avoid all of these schools, you'd be hard pressed to find a place to go to school. That's how pervasive it is.
Right. I mean, it's similar. I mean, there's websites that are solely dedicated to ranking schools based on their cost, most affordable. And it's not saying don't attend. They're just simply presenting the information. So I would argue that this is just as important of a tool to have in the College Search toolbox for families that are looking through institutions where their kids might be heading, just to understand the landscape of the institution they're considering. So you're involved professionally in higher education. From your perspective, how are you seeing the increased adoption of critical race theory and its tenets? How is that changing the landscape of higher education?
Well, one way is through mandates and other requirements. There's consideration at Cornell. The Faculty Senate finally rendered its final report, or I should say the working group from the Faculty Senate. And there are mandates in there. And it has received a surprising pushback. Actually, it's surprised me very much. Now, the pushback has not been so much we disagree with critical race theory or we disagree with this anti-racism agenda. It's more this is an infringement of our academic freedom as faculty. And it's an infringement of student academic freedom. So I don't know what's going to happen. They've changed the language. They've warded it down from the faculty's. The original resolution was going to be that the Faculty Senate endorses the proposals from the working groups. Now it's because of the pushback, it's going to be that the Faculty Senate recommends that the president give it serious consideration. So it's gone from we endorse it to give it serious consideration. Now the Faculty Senate has no power to do anything. It's merely advisory. The president passed it off to the Faculty Senate, she said, because of shared governance on campus, that things that impact the curriculum and that impact faculty should at least initially be considered by the Faculty Senate, the University Faculty Senate. And that's what's happened, but she could reject it entirely, accept it entirely. I don't know what she's going to do, but the fact that it has been watered down hopefully will send a message to the president of the university that she started this ball rolling downhill last July with her initiative, and it's gone off course. It's not right what's happening. I've issued public statements. I've written about it extensively. I've posted my comment at the Faculty Senate website where they're accepting faculty comments, and I've come out very strongly about it, against it, that it will have a negative effect in many different ways. One is it's anti-educational. Anytime you have coercion, that it's anti-educational. Now people say, well, you require students, or I don't, the university does, to take, you know, freshman English or something like that. Actually, I'd be fine if they dropped that, but that's not an ideology, okay? That's a foundational. So there are certain requirements that are considered foundational. Now, the supporters of critical race theory would say they think it should be foundational. I disagree with that. But it is coercive. No matter how you measure it, it's coercive. There are no other ideological-based courses that are required university-wide. There may be departmental courses that are required to get your major, but that's a little different. And on faculty, it really would be unprecedented to require faculty to go through these trainings. The only trainings that I'm aware of are the ones mandated by state law. Every certain number of years, you have to take an online module regarding sexual harassment. And that's a state law requirement. That's not a Cornell requirement. So this would be, to my knowledge, the first required training module that faculty would have to take. So one, it's coercive, it's anti-educational, it's an infringement of our academic freedom. And it also essentially adopts an official ideology for the university. If you read, or your listeners read, the working group proposals, they start with language about how faculty and students must, using the word must, understand and accept, you know, systemic racism, et cetera, et cetera. So they're kind of in the wherefore clauses, they're establishing an official ideology at the campus, which we've never done before and shouldn't be done. And last but not least, it will have a very chilling effect on free expression on campus, because if you disagree with what they say, you are now not only smeared as a racist, you're now arguably in violation of university policy. And Cornell already has a free expression problem. The Foundation for Individual Rights in Education last fall released a survey of 55 schools, colleges, and universities. I'm not sure how they picked them, but they were all names you would recognize. And Cornell was ranked 40th out of the 55, which is a bad ranking. And we ranked particularly low on students' feelings about their ability to express themselves. So it ranked very low. I think it was 2/3 or more of Cornell students who were surveyed said they do not feel free to express their opinions on campus. And so you combine it all, and it's taking a not good situation and making it a lot worse. So to me, it's a disaster. It is going down the wrong road. Even if you agree with critical race theory, my goodness, you can't shake a stick on campus without hitting a course or a workshop or a protest or a student activist group. I mean, the critical race is everywhere on campus, and that's not enough for them. It's not enough for them to do it. They're obviously not getting the attendance they want. It's probably the same 100 people going to each of these events every time in a student population of 17,000. So now they're going to use coercion to force people to take it. And I think maybe they should be asking themselves why on a liberal campus their ideas are not more popular. They're not penetrating more. People don't want to take their courses. I mean, there's a certain group that does, and that's fine. I'm not saying they shouldn't be able to offer it. But why do they have to go to coercion? And I think that's the one thing they don't want to talk about, is why they have to force people to do it.
Right. And this brings me back to a point that you brought up earlier in this little piece here. The fact that this would be, I'll say, essentially mandating an ideology that the universities are taking a stance on. When it comes down to the micro level in these conversations, we get down to the core of that. Why can't we bridge this gap? Those that are for this mandating of the ideology of critical race theory on campuses and those that don't. One side sees it as an ideology and that it's forcing that. The other side that's pro critical race theory, whether they believe it, what they're saying or not, that it's not an ideology. How do we get past this divide?
Well, I think by not forcing it on people, that if they want to make the case that this is the direction we should be going, let them make the case. So I'm not going to tell people what the outcome should be, except that it shouldn't be mandated. That's my only issue.
Well, and I think so much of what we're seeing too, I mean, there's been a lot of buzz within state legislators, legislation putting through bans of mandating this in higher education, which I think is great. You know, Idaho has been a really great example in the recent weeks. Florida, Oklahoma is coming on board as well. But there's so many that don't appear to be reading the actual legislation that's being put through, that this is not a ban on teaching tenets of critical race theory. A lot of what's happening at the state level is banning the mandates in higher education. So what would you say to those folks that, you know, maybe aren't seeing that piece and they're seeing it as attack on their
free speech? There's several different levels there. The first is K-12. Okay. K-12 does not have the concepts of academic freedom, et cetera, that you have in higher ed. And there's good reason for that. These are state institutions. Now, there are some state institutions of higher ed, but they are state institutions where students are required to attend by force of law, okay, unless they want to go to a private school. So, but most people can't afford private school. So you are forcing people, under threat of the truancy cop, if they still have those things, dragging them in. So it's a captive audience. It's an involuntary audience. And traditionally, K through 12 curricula has been highly regulated and mandated by the state. So it's a completely different area. So let's take K through 12 first. What we've seen there is essentially attempts to ban rogue teachers from introducing this and rogue school boards from introducing this. And I think that could be effective. And I think it is appropriate for a mandated curriculum in a mandated attendance school that is the government. I think the government gets to decide what gets taught in K through 12 in public schools. They just do. They always have. So I don't think that, see that as any abridgment. The higher ed is a different scenario because there is that tradition of academic freedom in higher ed for faculty. So I think legislators, when they're drafting these things, have to draw that distinction between K through 12. And frankly, I would rather they focus on K through 12 than on higher ed. In higher ed, I think there would be problems if they, quote unquote, banned the teaching of something. Whereas I think they can do it in K through 12. It's just two different scenarios. What they can say is that no funding should be used for it, things like that. So there are free speech issues, there are academic freedom issues, and I would encourage any state legislators considering this for higher ed to draw it very specifically and very narrowly, whereas I think they have much greater ability to influence what happens in the public elementary and secondary schools. And so, and frankly, that in many ways is currently where the problem is. People always or frequently say to me, is higher ed lost? And the answer is probably, okay? That doesn't mean it's lost for every student or in every department or in every classroom. But if you look at the skew in faculty political leanings, I forget who released the study, but I read it maybe a year ago, and they were tracking the history of how professors at universities self-identify. And if you go back only 30 or 40 years, and I was actually surprised how even it was about 60-40 liberal to conservative. What I wouldn't do to have those days back. And now it's about, I forget if it was 18 or 20 to 1. And if you look at the professors who are entering the system, not the entirety, not including the 63-year-olds, okay, but if you look at the ones hired in the last 5 years, it's something like 28 to 1 or 40 to 1. It's essentially entirely self-identified as liberal leftist. And so that is not a situation that can be changed quickly. It took a generation or two to get that way. Faculty hiring is generally within the domain of departments. Yes, it needs to be approved by the provost, et cetera. But, you know, the central administration generally doesn't do the hiring. So the people who are doing the hiring are the people who are to the left. And, you know, and that's a problem. So yes, to that extent, higher ed faculty has been lost. On many campuses, the campus culture has been lost, but that's more changeable. That's, and I would urge people to focus on the campus culture. One proposal I have, and I really haven't fleshed it out, and I haven't written about it, is that diversity of thought should be put on the same level as diversity of race and ethnicity. That every university, just about, has pretty sizable bureaucracies devoted to diversity, equity, and inclusion. Some of them are relatively traditional. Some of them are complete Kendian critical race theory types. I bet you there isn't a single university in America that has administrators devoted to diversity of thought. And, you know, universities, while they can't mandate racial quotas for hiring, although they try to do it with a nod and a wink, they can mandate diversification of pools of applicants. They can mandate those things. Why not mandate those for diversity of viewpoint? We're not going to tell the philosophy department who they have to hire, but we are going to require that they not only seek out a pool of racially and ethnically diverse potential applicants, that they also seek that out in terms of viewpoint diversity. Now, how you define that, I realize, you know, you can spin all you want on that, but I think universities need to elevate diversity of viewpoint to the same level as diversity of race and ethnicity. And the first major university that does that, I think, will get an enormous amount of positive publicity. Maybe Cornell will be the first. Who knows?
I would agree. And it's almost an art that's lost, because it's not something on campuses right now that is encouraged necessarily. Just even the idea of civil discourse within a course at an individual level, I know that there are faculty that still do appreciate that and foster a really good atmosphere for that. But largely, it seems that that part is lost in higher education, which is really unfortunate.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. The backing up that whole viewpoint, Cornell Sun student newspaper did a couple of studies in the last few years of faculty political donations. And no surprise, approaching 100%, something like nine, depending on the year, 97 to 99%. Are two Democrats. And so that's not an exact proxy for ideology, but it is a proxy for ideology. And so that's the campus culture.
Well, and you've got a long history in higher education. Did you ever imagine yourself teaching in a time where this was the biggest
higher
issue?
Ed was not my first career. I was a practicing lawyer for 22, 23 years before I switched over to academia. I became very ill and had to close my law practice. And, you know, as the saying goes, those who can't do teach. So after a year of sitting at home, I said, Cornell is looking for somebody exactly in my specialty. How is that? How hard can it be to teach? So I threw in a resume, and the next thing you know, I'm hired. And I've been there ever since. So I was hired in the fall of 2006. I'm confusing my years now. Fall of 2007, and I started January 2008. And at the time I started, I did not have my website. My website was founded in October 2008, 10 months later. There isn't a single doubt in my mind that if I had my website, I would not have been hired. Not even a close call. I think that's just a given. So, I think that that is another example. Don't take me as proof the system welcomes diversity of opinion. Take me as one that it's one slip through the cracks.
Yeah, well, I mean, you talked about the attempt of canceling you. I mean, I can't imagine being in the middle of that. It's got to be, lack of better terms, a nightmare to be the target of something like that. Especially when you're doing something you're passionate about, you're there for a sincere reason.
Nobody has ever said I wrote anything wrong about the Black Lives Matter movement. No one's proven me factually inaccurate. What triggered the attempts to get me fired, the alumni petitions, the student boycotts, was the post I wrote about Michael Brown being a fabricated narrative. And I was allowed to see one of the alumni letters on the condition that I not quote it. So I won't quote it, but I can paraphrase it. And basically it was, you're insensitive. That how, I don't know whether you're right or you're wrong about Michael Brown, but it's extremely insensitive to say, write something like this just a week or 10 days after George Floyd's death. And therefore you have no basis being here. It's the continuation of, you know, freedom of expression, freedom of speech, academic freedom turns on how it makes somebody feel, as opposed to, yes, right. And so if my saying this, which is true, what I wrote, makes somebody feel bad, they think they have the right to get me fired or the right to boycott, organize a boycott of my course. The course boycott, by the way, failed. Okay. And we were oversubscribed as we always are. I actually received a significant support from students who emailed me and said that do not think these student activists speak for everybody, that you actually have a lot of support in the building, but it's quiet support because everybody's afraid to speak up. And I get that. I get that. You know, one of the things that the way I was treated, including by the administration, is that it scares others into silence. And, you know, so that's really the downside of it. Fortunately, because I had the website, because we were pretty well known, because I had done a lot of media myself on other things, you know, and been on TV and been in radio and a lot of newspaper coverage of things long before this, when this happened to me, it received an enormous amount of coverage. And I received, I don't know how many, at least several hundred emails from around the country of from people who say, you know, thank you for speaking up. I wish I could at work, but I'd get fired. I'm worried about being fired. And please don't use my name. I support you, but please don't use my name. And I appreciate those, and I get it. I really do get it. And I think that, you know, faculty are the same way. Not at the law school. I didn't receive a single message of support from any faculty member of the law school. And in fact, 21 of them signed a letter against me in collusion with the student group. So one of the things that happened after this kind of burst forward is certain people sent me certain things. And I was able to see that faculty were colluding with the students. And that's when I decided to go public with it. When it was just alumni writing in, you know what? For 10 years, alumni have been writing in complaining about me. Okay. You know, I didn't think it would go anywhere. But 21 of your colleagues, including people you considered friends, never even approach you. They just sign a letter for the Cornell Sun. And they don't use your name in it, but it's clear who it's about. And they tell the student groups that it's about me. Behind my back, and not one of them ever approached me and said, we don't like this word you used. I mean, that was basically their gripe. We don't like this word you used, that word you used, et cetera, et cetera. Nobody asked me for an explanation. Nobody asked me for my view. And in fact, they were, you know, one of these moral panics where they're rushing to be the first one to condemn me. People couldn't wait. Who's going to be the first one? And my 21 of my closest colleagues wanted to be the first one to condemn me. And so they rushed their statement out before the students had even rushed their statement out. And that's how horrible it is. And so, but with the outpouring of support from elsewhere, it really did make me able to get through it. And I've tried to take a positive attitude towards it in that coming on shows like this and talking about it and going on TV and talking about it and writing about it, et cetera. You know, one of the internal documents actually said that they wanted to get me fired, but they thought that would look bad because it would generate too much publicity and it would just increase my platform. Okay. I already had a big platform at Legal Insurrection. Okay. You know, that's right. And the faculty letter that they published in the Cornell Sun said, we're not going to name the person because we don't want to give him a platform for his racist ideology. You know, and obviously what I was saying was not in the least bit racist. It was simply a criticism of rioting and looting and a pointing out a historical truth, which is Michael Brown was not shot because his hands were up and he was saying, don't shoot. He was shot because he punched a policeman in the face and tried to steal his weapon. And that's the first shot. And then he made a second charge at the policeman and that was the fatal shot. And the policeman wasn't charged for good reason, but it set off weeks and weeks of rioting in Ferguson, Missouri. And it burst Black Lives Matter onto the national scene. The hashtag Black Lives Matter was created after the Trayvon Martin case, a George Zimmerman trial, which we covered extensively every single day at the website. And that was a justifiable use of force also. The jury got that one right. But that's when the hashtag was created. But it was Ferguson and it was Michael Brown that pushed the movement national and really made it the leader that it became. And And it's all embedded with the fabricated narrative of the Michael Brown case. And so they, nobody said I'm wrong. Not a single person to this day has said I'm wrong about that.
That's what's wild about it. It's almost unfathomable. And it, to me, when I think of these things related to the campus culture, it's almost the chicken before the egg argument. You know, we talk so much about how university faculty overwhelmingly lean to the left politically, administration the same way. And I think that it's justifiable to say that that does have an influence on how campus culture is and how students are behaving on campuses. But do you think that the student population, the generation that's coming through college right now, are more activist-based? They seem to be very politically involved, but are they fueling a lot of what's happening on campus, or is it vice versa?
Well, it's hard to know, because there's the public side of higher ed and then the private side. And the public side are the student activists, the student groups. You know, so it's hard to know how deeply that has penetrated. You know, 10% of the campus may be highly radicalized and activist. And you might say, well, that's only 10%. But you know what? That's a very vocal. They're the ones who get on the student government. They're the ones who edit the newspaper and write for the newspaper. They're the ones who lead the student groups who organize boycotts against professors like me. Okay. And so 10% can actually run the campus. And so it's very hard to know. I mean, I think there's no question that, you know, students of a younger generation are more liberal, more to the left than maybe before. I'm not sure if that's changed, how much that's changed. You know, are they going to be that way when they're 35? You know, I mean, that's the question. I think probably yes. I think there has been a shift, you know, but not perhaps as much a shift as you would think from the student activists. And that's, I think, really the key. A lot of students are scared, okay? A lot of students tell me that they are afraid to speak up about anything. A lot of students, they just want to keep their head down and emerge from college, or particularly professional school like law school. They just want to emerge from law school with nothing bad about them on the internet, because they know when they go for a job, the law firm, either themselves or they're going to hire a service to do it, is going to you know, do Google searches on people. And if they find that someone was called a racist, they're not going to take the time to figure out whether that was accurate. And so the internet has had such a pernicious effect on this. The ability to destroy somebody's career with frivolous accusations put out on the internet, sometimes anonymously, but if they show up in Google searches, it can cause real damage to somebody. And that reign of terror, that reign of internet terror, plays into all of this stuff about what's going on. And it's the same for faculty as well.
Well, that leads into wrapping up our conversation today. I think so much of what you're saying rings true with a lot of people. Unfortunately, it's not the vocal majority or minority that feel this way. But I think many more are waking up to what's happening right now. And I appreciate the work that you're doing, not only with criticalrace.org, but just sharing your story of what you've been through, and that it's possible to stick it out through this and come out on the other side still remaining positive. And I think that's a great, great piece to all this. A huge piece of the work you're doing with criticalrace.org is really just to provide that resource for students and families as they're going through that college search process. And for me, it hits home because I've been working for the last 8 years in higher ed admissions and enrollment management. And I see it as such a key piece to this college search process that lasts for years. I mean, college search starts even before freshman year in high school now. So much of recruitment happens in elementary schools, and just getting them used to the idea of a four-year degree is what's happening next in your life. I would love for you to break apart two different groups here and share some advice for parents as they're going through the college search with their young kids, and then also for the students that are finding themselves maybe junior, senior year in high school. How do you navigate this? Are there questions they should be asking colleges if they're visiting? How should they be going through this process while incorporating the research with critical race theory?
Yeah, well, on our website, I don't know if it's there yet, but it's going to be there any moment. It's ready to go. We've created a list of questions that students or parents can or should ask. We've done it in a letter format, but you don't need to do it in a letter. You could just ask them, or you could look on the website. So I think the first thing is spend as much time understanding the campus culture and the campus requirements as you do figuring out how good the dining room food is, okay? I mean, people, students particularly, high school students, I think particularly focus on very strange things sometimes. You know, what are the athletic facilities like? You know, how late are things open on campus, you know? So while I know there's a tension and in some place, some families, the parents will have a lot of input, you know, there's not so much, but I think a lot of the burden falls on the parents because the students may not necessarily know what to look for. They may have other priorities, you know, and so I think parents need to do a lot of that, but students too. I mean, there are many capable high school students. And just understand the culture. Read the student newspaper. Go, it's all online now. Go back and read the student newspaper. What that will tell you what's happening on campus. Maybe a little bit of a skewed view, but if there's negative stuff happening on campus, it's probably in the student newspaper at most schools. Do internet searches. Visit the campus. You know, if every wall is plastered with is the equivalent of propaganda posters, that's a sign of something. You know, really do your homework because you're going to spend 2 or 4 years at this place and you're going to spend a ton of money at this place. And I think you owe it to yourself and you owe it to your child to understand what you're getting yourself involved in, both from an educational perspective, but also from a social perspective and from a risk perspective. You know, there are schools that are in the newspaper frequently where people are targeted by these activist students. And I would frankly, personally, I would stay away from those places. You know, if you've got, you know, places like, you know, Middlebury College, where they shouted down and attacked a professor, where the student body seems to be completely radicalized. My alma mater, Hamilton College in upstate New York, which used to be a very kind of staid, you know, by the book, liberal arts education is completely radicalized now. Understand what you're getting yourself into because you may not only be deprived of educational opportunities, you may not only be forced to sit through some class and nod your head with the professor and regurgitate to the professor on the final exam what you know the professor wants to hear about critical race theory and how evil the United States is because you don't want a bad grade, okay? Which I think is what a lot of students do. They understand the game that gets played, but you are actually putting yourself at risk if you go to a highly radicalized school, particularly a highly radicalized small school. Because at a big university, you can kind of find your own space, you can find your own crowd, but at a 1,500 or 2,000 student school, there's no place to hide. And you could very easily find your name all over the internet accused of something because you looked at somebody the wrong way. Look at what's coming out about what happened at Smith College, where this cafeteria worker and a security guard were falsely accused of racial profiling, destroyed them. It's tearing apart the school. You know, there are real consequences to this movement that we're seeing, which is a combination of cancel culture, critical race theory, Marxism, and just mean-spiritedness of the type that, you know, people can be very cruel to each other when they have the power to do that. And that's what you're seeing in a lot of these places. It's cancel culture, critical race theory, and cruelty.
Yeah, the trifecta. It just sounds awful when you say it like that. But I think this at the core of this, though, I mean, it really comes down to, you know, families that are concerned about this, it really opens up the door to have these conversations with kids before they get into college. And the resource that you've got with criticalrace.org is just an excellent example of how families can be looking at this. So I, again, appreciate your work on that. So definitely we'll be linking up to criticalrace.org in the show notes for this. Are there other ways that our listeners can get involved or see what work you're working on?
Sure. Legalinsurrection.com is our main website. You could also Google Legal Insurrection Foundation. You can also Google my name, William Jacobson, but please ignore all the nonsense.
Well, thanks so much for your time being with us today, Bill. I really appreciate your insight, your perspective, and the work you're doing. We'll definitely link up to everything that you mentioned in our show notes, and we'll look forward to just tracking where criticalrace.org goes and how fast it grows.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on.
Before we wrap up the show today, I want to remind you that Freeborn and Liberty is now on YouTube, and so now you can stream all of the show's episodes. And I'd appreciate if you subscribe to our channel and other social platforms as well. Again, we're on Twitter at @free_libertypod and Facebook, Freeborn and Liberty. If you haven't subscribed yet to The Nonconformist, our weekly email newsletter, grab your spot on our email list by going to the contact page on freebornandliberty.com. Thanks again for listening and for all of your continued support. I'm really looking forward to having you back next week to join in the conversation about how the woke ideology is impacting higher education. Have a great week. The views, information, and opinions on Freeborn and Liberty shared by the host and the guests are in no way representative of the institutions with which they are affiliated, nor do they represent the views of their employers.